They walked in silence for a moment. "Ah," said Susan dully, "trickery with words. I would have thought you'd have been more literal-minded than that." "I am nothing if not literal-minded. Trickery with words is where humans live." "All right," said Susan, "I'm not stupid. You're saying humans need fantasies to make life bearable."
"Really? As if it was some kind of pink pill?" "No, humans need fantasy to be human. To be the place where the falling angel meets the rising ape."
"Tooth fairies, hogfathers, little..."
"Yes. As practice, you have to start out learning how to believe the little lies."
"So we can believe the big ones?"
"Yes. Justice, mercy, duty, that sort of thing."
"They're not the same at all."
"You think so? Then take the universe and grind it down to the finest powder and sieve it through the finest sieve, and then show me one atom of justice, one molecule of mercy. And yet..." Death waved a hand. "And yet you act as if there is some ideal order in the world, as if there is some rightness in the universe by which it may be judged."
"Yes, but people have got to believe that, or what's the point?"
"My point, exactly."
She tried to assemble her thoughts.
"There is a place where two galaxies have been colliding for 1,000,000 years, said Death, apropos of nothing. "Don't try to tell me that's right."
"Yes, but people don't think about that," said Susan. Somewhere there was a bed.
"Correct. Stars explode, worlds collide. There's hardly anywhere in the universe where humans can live without being frozen or fried. And yet you believe that a bed is a normal thing. It is the most amazing talent."
"Talent?"
"Oh, yes. A very special kind of stupidity. You think the whole universe is inside your heads."
"You make us sound mad," said Susan. "A nice, warm bed."
"No, you need to believe in things that aren't true. How else can they become?" said Death, helping her up onto Binky.
"These mountains," said Susan as the horse rose, "are they real mountains or some sort of shadows?"
"Yes."
Susan knew that was all she was going to get. I lost the sword. It's somewhere in the Tooth Fairy's country." Death shrugged.
"I can make another."
"Can you?"
"Oh, yes. It will give me something to do. Don't worry about it."
The senior wrangler hummed cheerfully to himself as he ran a comb through his beard for the second time and liberally sprinkled it with what would turn out to be a preparation of weasel extract for demon removal rather than, as he had assumed, a pleasant masculine scent. It was, in fact, a pleasant masculine scent, but only to female weasels. Then he stepped out into his study.
"Sorry for the delay, but..." he began.
There was no one there. Only very far off the sound of someone blowing her nose, mingling with the glingling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling of fading magic. The light was already gilding the top of the Tower of Art when Binky trotted to a standstill on the air beside the nursery balcony. Susan climbed down onto the fresh snow and stood uncertainly for a moment. When someone has gone out of their way to drop you home, it's only courteous to ask them in. On the other hand...
"Would you like to visit for Hogswatch dinner?" said Death.
He sounded hopeful.
"Albert is frying a pudding."
"Frying a pudding?"
"Albert understands frying, and I believe he's making jam. He certainly kept talking about it."
They're really expecting me here," said Susan. "The Gators do a lot of entertaining. His business friends. Probably the whole day will be... I'll more or less have to look after the children."
"Someone should."
Would you like a drink before you go?" said Susan, giving in.
"A cup of cocoa would be appropriate in the circumstances."
"Right. There's biscuits in the tin on the mantelpiece." Susan headed with relief into the tiny kitchen. Death sat down in the creaking wicker chair, buried his feet in the rug, and looked around with interest. He heard the clatter of cups, and then a sound like indrawn breath, and then silence. Death helped himself to a biscuit from the tin. There were two full stockings hanging from the mantelpiece. He prodded them with professional satisfaction, and then sat down again and observed the nursery wallpaper. It seemed to be pictures of rabbits in waistcoats, among other fauna. He was not surprised. Death occasionally turned up in person, even for rabbits, simply to see that the whole process was working properly. He'd never seen one wearing a waistcoat. He wouldn't have expected waistcoats. At least, he wouldn't have expected waistcoats if he hadn't had some experience of the way humans portrayed the universe. As it was only a blessing they hadn't been given gold watches and top hats as well. Humans liked dancing pigs, too, and lambs in hats. As far as Death was aware, the sole reason for any human association with pigs and lambs was a prelude to chops and sausages. Quite why they should dress up for children's wallpaper as well was a mystery. "Hello, little folk, this is what you're going to eat." He felt that if only he could find the key to it, he'd know a lot more about human beings. His gaze travelled to the door. Susan's governess coat and hat were hanging on it. The coat was grey, and so was the hat, grey and round and dull. Death didn't know many things about the human psyche, but he did know protective coloration when he saw it. Dullness. Only humans could have invented it. What imaginations they had. The door opened. To his horror, Death saw a small child of unidentifiable sex come out of the bedroom, amble sleepily across the floor, and unhook the stockings from the mantelpiece. It was halfway back before it noticed him, and then it simply stopped and regarded him thoughtfully. He knew that young children could see him because they hadn't yet developed that convenient and selective blindness that comes with the intimation of personal mortality. He felt a little embarrassed.
"Susan's got a poker, you know," it said, as if anxious to be helpful.
"Well, well, indeed. My goodness me!
I thought all of you knew that now. Last week, she picked a bogey up by its nose."
Death tried to imagine this. He felt sure he'd heard the sentence wrong, but it didn't sound a whole lot better, however he rearranged the words.
"I'll give Gawain his stocking, and then I'll come and watch," said the child. It padded out.
Susan,
Death said, calling in reinforcements. Susan backed out of the kitchen, a black kettle in her hand. There was a figure behind her. In the half-light, the sword gleamed blue along its blade, its glitter reflected off one glass eye.
"Well, well," said Tea Time, quietly, glancing at Death. "Now this is unexpected. A family affair."
The sword hummed back and forth.
"I wonder," said Tea Time, "is it possible to kill Death? This must be a very special sword, and it certainly works here."
He raised a hand to his mouth for a moment and gave a little chuckle.
"And, of course, it might well not be regarded as murder. Possibly it is a civic act. It would be, as they say, the big one. Stand up, sir. You may have some personal knowledge about your vulnerability, but I'm pretty certain that Susan here would quite definitely die, so I'd rather you didn't try any last-minute stuff."
"I am last-minute stuff," said Death, standing up. Tea Time circled around carefully, the sword's tip making little curves in the air. From the next room came the sound of someone trying to blow a whistle quietly. Susan glanced at her grandfather.
"I don't remember them asking for anything that made a noise," she said.
"Oh, there has to be something in the stocking that makes a noise," said Death. "Otherwise, what is 4:30 a.m. for?"
"There are children," said Tea Time.
"Oh, yes, of course. Call them."
"Certainly not."
"It will be instructive," said Tea Time. "Educational. And when your adversary is Death, you cannot help but be the good guy."
He pointed the sword at Susan.
"I said, call them."
Susan glanced hopefully at her grandfather. He nodded. For a moment, she thought she saw the glow in one eye socket flicker off and on, Death's equivalent of a wink.
"He's got a plan. He can stop him. He can do anything. He's got a plan.
Gawain! Twyla!"
The muffled noises stopped in the next room. There was a padding of feet and two solemn faces appeared round the door.
"Ah, come in! Come in, curly-haired tots," said Tea Time genially.
Gawain gave him a steely stare. His next mistake, thought Susan. If he'd called them little bastards, he'd have them bang on his side. But they know when you're sending them up.
"I've caught this bogeyman," said Tea Time. "What shall we do with him, eh?"
The two faces turned to death. Twyla put her thumb in her mouth.
"It's only a skeleton," said Gawain critically.
Susan opened her mouth and the sword swung towards her. She shut it again.
"Yes, a nasty, creepy, horrible skeleton," said Tea Time. "Scary, eh?"
There was a very faint pop as Twyla took her thumb out of her mouth.
"He's eating a biscuit," she said.
"Biscuit," Susan corrected automatically. She started to swing the kettle in an absent-minded way.
"A creepy, bony man in a black robe," said Tea Time, aware that things weren't going quite in the right direction.
He spun round to face Susan.
"You're fidgeting with that kettle," he said, "so I expect you're thinking of doing something creative. Put it down, please, slowly."
Susan knelt down gently and put the kettle on the hearth.
"Huh, that's not very creepy, it's just bones," said Gawain dismissively. "And anyway, Willie the groom down at the stables has promised me a real horse skull, and anyway, I'm going to make a hat out of it like General Tacticus had when he wanted to frighten people, and anyway, it's just standing there, it's not even making woo-woo noises, and anyway, you're creepy. Your eye's weird."
"Really? Then let's see how creepy I can be," said Tea Time.
Blue fire crackled along the sword as he raised it. Susan closed her hand over the poker. Tea Time saw her start to turn. He stepped behind Death, sword raised. Susan threw the poker overarm. It made a ripping noise as it shot through the air and trailed sparks. It hit Death's robe and vanished. He blinked. Tea Time smiled at Susan. He turned and peered dreamily at the sword in his hand. It fell out of his fingers. Death turned and caught it by the handle as it tumbled and turned its fall into an upward curve. Tea Time looked down at the poker in his chest as he folded up.
"Oh, no," he said. "It couldn't have gone through you. There are so many ribs and things."
There was another pop as Twyla extracted her thumb and said,
"It only kills monsters."
"Stop time now," commanded Susan. Death snapped his fingers. The room took on the greyish purple of stationary time. The clock paused its ticking.
"You winked at me. I thought you had a plan."
"Indeed. Oh, yes. I planned to see what you would do."
"Just that?"
"You are very resourceful, and of course you have had an education."
"What?"
"I did add the sparkly stars and the noise, though. I thought they would be appropriate."
"And if I hadn't done anything?"
"I dare say I would have thought of something at the last minute."
"That was the last minute."
"There is always time for another last minute."
"The children had to watch that."
"Educational. The world will teach them about monsters soon enough. Let them remember there's always the poker."
"But they saw he's human."
"I think they had a very good idea of what he was."
Death prodded the fallen Tea Time with his foot.
"Stop playing dead, Mr. Te-a-Time."
The ghost of the assassin sprang up like a jack-in-the-box, all slightly crazed smiles.
"You got it right."
"Of course."
Tea Time began to fade.
"I'll take the body," said Death. "That will prevent inconvenient questions."
"What did he do it all for?" said Susan. "I mean, why? Money? Power?"
"Some people will do anything for the sheer fascination of doing it," said Death. "Or for fame. Or because they shouldn't."
Death picked up the corpse and slung it over his shoulder. There was a sound of something bouncing on the hearth. He turned and hesitated.
You did know the poker would go through me."
Susan realized she was shaking.
"Of course. In this room it's pretty powerful."
"You were never in any doubt."
Susan hesitated and then smiled. "I was quite confident," she said.
"Ah."
Her grandfather stared at her for a moment, and she thought she detected just the tiniest flicker of uncertainty.
"Of course. Of course. Tell me, are you likely to take up teaching on a larger scale?"
"I hadn't planned to."
Death turned towards the balcony and then seemed to remember something else. He fumbled inside his robe.
"I have made this for you."
She reached out and took a square of damp cardboard. Water dripped off the bottom. Somewhere in the middle, a few brown feathers seem to have been glued on. Thank you. What is it?
Albert said there ought to be snow on it, but it appears to have melted, said Death. It is, of course, a Hogswatch card.
Oh.
There should have been a robin on it as well, but I had considerable difficulty in getting it to stay on.
Ah.
It was not at all cooperative.
Really,
it did not seem to get into the Hogswatch spirit at all.
Oh, good. Grandad?
Yes?
Why? I mean, why did you do all this? He stood quite still for a moment, as if he was trying out sentences in his mind.
I think it's something to do with harvests, he said at last. Yes, that's right. And because humans are so interesting that they have even invented dullness. Quite astonishing.
Oh.
Well then, happy Hogswatch.
Yes, happy Hogswatch.
Death paused again at the window.
And good night, children. Everywhere.
The raven fluttered down onto a log covered in snow. Its prosthetic red breast had been torn and fluttered uselessly behind it.
Not so much as a lift home, it muttered. Look at this, will you? Snow and frozen wastes everywhere. I couldn't fly another damn inch. I could starve to death here, you know. People are going on about recycling the whole time, but you just try a bit of practical ecology and they just don't want to know. I bet a robin would have a lift home. Oh, yes.
Squeak, said the Death of Rats sympathetically and sniffed.
The raven watched the small hooded figure scrabble at the snow.
So I'll just freeze to death here, shall I? It said gloomily. A pathetic bundle of feathers with my little feet curled up with the cold. It's not even as if I'm going to make anyone a good meal. And let me tell you, it's a disgrace to die thin in my species.
It became aware that under the snow was a rather grubbier whiteness. Further scraping by the rat exposed something that could very possibly have been an ear. The raven stared.
It's a sheep, it said.
The Death of Rats nodded.
A whole sheep.
Which had died in its sleep, of natural causes, at a great age. After a long and happy life, insofar as a sheep can be happy, and would probably be quite pleased to know that it could help somebody as it passed away.
Squeak. Oh, well, said the raven, hopping forward with its eyes spinning. Hey, it's barely cool.
The Death of Rats patted it happily on a wing.
Squeak, eek, eek, squeak. Why, thanks, and the same to you.
Far, far away, and a long, long time ago, a shop door opened. The little toy maker bustled in from the workshop in the rear, and then stopped with amazing foresight, dead.
You have a big wooden rocking horse in the window, said the new customer.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
The shopkeeper fiddled nervously with his square-rimmed spectacles. He hadn't heard the bell, and this was worrying him.
But I'm afraid that's just for show. That is a special order for Lord...
No, I will buy it.
No, because you see...
There are other toys?
Yes, indeed, but...
Then I will take the horse. How much would this lordship have paid you?
We agreed $12, but...
I will give you 50. Said the customer.
The little shopkeeper stopped in mid-remonstrate and started up in mid-greed. There were other toys, he told himself quickly, and this customer, he thought with considerable prescience, looked like someone who did not take no for an answer and seldom even bothered to ask the question. Lord Selachi would be angry, but Lord Selachi wasn't here. The stranger, on the other hand, was here, incredibly here.
In the circumstances, shall I wrap it up for you?
No, I will take it as it is, thank you. I will leave via the back way, if it's all the same to you.
How did you get in?
Said the shopkeeper, pulling the horse out of the window.
Through the wall. So much more convenient than chimneys, don't you think?
The apparition dropped a small clinking bag on the counter and lifted the horse easily. The shopkeeper wasn't in a position to hold on to anything. Even yesterday's dinner was threatening to leave him.
The figure looked at the other shelves.
You make good toys.
Thank you.
Incidentally, said the customer as he left, there is a small boy out there with his nose frozen to the window. Some warm water should do the trick.
Death walked out to where Binky was waiting in the snow and tied the toy horse behind the saddle.
Albert will be very pleased. I can't wait to see his face. Who?
As the light of Hogswatch slid down the towers of Unseen University, the librarian slipped into the great hall with some sheet music clenched firmly in his feet. As the light of Hogswatch lit the towers of the Unseen University, the Arch-Chancellor sat down with a sigh in his study and pulled off his boots. It had been a damn long night, no doubt about it. Lots of strange things. First time he'd ever seen the senior wrangler burst into tears, for one thing. Ridcully glanced at the door to the new bathroom. Well, he'd sorted out the teething troubles, and a nice warm shower would be very refreshing. And then he could go along to the organ recital, all nice and clean. He removed his hat, and someone fell out of it with a tinkling sound. A small gnome rolled across the floor.
"Oh, another one! I thought we'd got rid of you fellows," said Ridcully. "And what are you?"
The gnome looked at him nervously.
You know, whenever there was another magical appearance, you heard the sound of, bells," it said.
Its expression suggested it was owning up to something it just knew was going to get it a smack.
Yes?
The gnome held up some rather small handbells and waved them nervously. They went glingle-lingle-lingle-lingle-lingle in a very sad way.
Good, eh? That was me. I'm the glingle-lingle-lingle-lingle fairy.
Get out! I also do sparkly fairy dust effects that go twing, too, if you like. Go away! How about the bells of St. Ungulance? Said the gnome desperately. Very seasonal, very nice. Why not join in? It goes, the bells clong of St. Clang.
Ridcully scored a direct hit with the rubber duck, and the gnome escaped through the bath overflow. Cursing and spontaneous handbell ringing echoed away down the pipes. In perfect peace at last, the Arch-Chancellor pulled off his robe. The organ's storage tanks were wheezing at the rivets by the time the librarian had finished pumping. Satisfied, he knuckled his way up to the seat and paused to survey with great satisfaction the keyboards in front of him. Bloody Stupid Johnson's approach to music was similar to his approach in every field that was caressed by his genius, in the same way that a potato field is touched by a late frost. "Make it loud," he said. "Make it wide. Make it all embracing." And thus the great organ of Unseen University was the only one in the world where you could play an entire symphony scored for thunderstorm and squashed toad noises. Warm water cascaded off Mustrum Ridcully's pointy bathing cap. Mr. Johnson had surely not on purpose designed a perfect bathroom, at least perfect for singing in. Echoes and resonating pipeways smoothed out all those little imperfections and gave even the weediest singer a rolling, dark brown voice. And so Ridcully sang.
As I walked out one, da-da-da-da-da, for to something or other, and to take thee, da-da-da-da, I did espy a fair pretty maiden, I think it was, and I...
The organ pipes hummed with pent-up energy. The librarian cracked his knuckles. This took some time. Then he pulled the pressure release valve. The hum became an urgent thrumming. Very carefully, he let in the clutch. Ridcully stopped singing as the tones of the organ came through the wall.
Bath-time music, eh? He thought. Just the job.
It was a shame it was muffled by all the bathroom fixtures, though. It was at this point he espied a small lever marked Musical Pipes. Ridcully, never being a man to wonder what any kind of switch did when it was so much easier and quicker to find out by pulling it, did so. But instead of the music he was expecting, he was rewarded simply with several large panels sliding silently aside, revealing row upon row of brass nozzles. The librarian was lost now, dreaming on the wings of music. His hands and feet danced over the keyboards, picking their way towards the crescendo, which ended the first movement of Bubbler's Catastrophe Suite. One foot kicked the afterburner lever, and the other spun the valve of the nitrous oxide cylinder. Ridcully tapped the nozzles. Nothing happened. He looked at the controls again and realised that he'd never pulled the little brass lever marked Organ Interlock. He did so. This did not cause a torrent of pleasant bath-time accompaniment, however. There was merely a thud and a distant gurgling which grew in volume. He gave up and went back to soaping his chest.
"Running of the deer, the playing of the... what?"
Later that day he had the bathroom nailed up again and a notice placed on the door on which was written, "Not to be used in any circumstances. This is important." However, when Modo nailed the door up, he didn't hammer the nails in all the way, but left just a bit sticking up so that his pliers would grip later on when he was told to remove them. He never presumed, and he never complained. He just had a good working knowledge of the wizardly mind. They never did find the soap. Ponder and his fellow students watched Hex carefully.
"It can't just, you know, stop,"
said Adrian, mad Drongo Turnipseed.
"The ants are just standing still," said Ponder.
He sighed.
"All right, put the wretched thing back."
Adrian carefully replaced the small fluffy teddy bear above Hex's keyboard. Things immediately began to whir. The ants started to trot again. The mouse squeaked. They tried this 3 times. Ponder looked again at the single sentence Hex had written. "Plus, plus, plus... mine, wah, plus, plus, plus."
"I don't actually think," he said gloomily, "that I want to tell the Arch-Chancellor that this machine stops working if we take its fluffy teddy bear away. I just don't think I want to live in that kind of world."
Said Mad Drongo, "you could always, you know, sort of say it needs to work with the FTB enabled."
"You think that's better?"
said Ponder, reluctantly. It wasn't as if it was even a very realistic interpretation of a bear.
"You mean better than fluffy teddy bear?"
Ponder nodded. "It's better," he said. Of all the presents he got from the Hogfather, Gawain told Susan, the best of all was the marble. And she'd said, "What marble?" And he'd said, "The glass marble I found in the fireplace. It wins all the games. It seems to move in a different way." The beggars walked their erratic and occasionally backward walk along the city streets, while fresh morning snow began to fall. Occasionally, one of them belched happily. They all wore paper hats, except for foul old Ron, who'd eaten his. A tin can was passed from hand to hand. It contained a mixture of fine wines and spirits and something in a can that Arnold Sideways has stolen from behind a paint factory in Phaedra Road.
"The goose was good," said the duck man, picking his teeth. "I'm surprised you ate it, what with that duck on your head,"
said Coffin Henry, picking his nose. "What duck?" said Duckman.
"What were that greasy stuff?"
said Arnold Sideways. "That, my dear fellow, was pâté de foie gras, all the way from Genoa, I'll wager, and very good too." "Dunno if make you fart, done it?"
"Ah, the world of haute cuisine," said the Duckman happily. They reached, by fits and starts, the back door of their favourite restaurant. The duck man looked at it dreamily, eyes filmy with recollection. "I used to dine here almost every night," he said.
"Why'd you stop?"
said Coffin Henry. "I don't really know," said the duck man. "It's rather a blur, I'm afraid. Back in the days when I think I was someone else. But still," he said, patting Arnold's head, "as they say, better a meal of old boots where friendship is than a stalled ox and hatred therewith. Forward, please, Ron." They positioned foul old Ron in front of the back door and then knocked on it. When a waiter opened it, foul old Ron grinned at him, exposing what remained of his teeth and his famous halitosis, which was still all there.
"Millennium hand and shrimp," he said, touching his forelock.
"Compliments of the season," the duck man translated. The man went to shut the door, but Arnold Sideways was ready for him and had wedged his boot in the crack. Arnold had no legs, but since there were many occasions when a boot was handy on the streets, Coffin Henry had affixed one to the end of a pole for him. He was deadly with it, and any muggers hard-pressed enough to try to rob the beggars often found themselves kicked on the top of the head by a man 3 feet high.
"We thought you might like us to come round at lunchtime and sing a merry Hogswatch glee for your customers," said the duck man.
Beside him, Coffin Henry began one of his volcanic bouts of coughing, which even sounded green. No charge, of course.
It being Hog's Watch, said Arnold.
The beggars, despite being too disreputable even to belong to the Beggars' Guild, lived quite well by their own low standards. This was generally by careful application of the certainty principle. People would give them all sorts of things if they were certain to go away. A few minutes later, they wandered off again, pushing a happy Arnold, who was surrounded by hastily wrapped packages. "People can be so kind," said the duck man.
"Me, Millennium Hand and Shrimp."
Arnold started to investigate the charitable donations as they manoeuvred his trolley through the slush and drifts.
"Tastes sort of familiar," he said.
"Familiar like what?"
"Like mud and old boots."
"Gone, that's posh grub, that is."
"Yeah, yeah."
Arnold chewed it for a while.
"You don't think we've become posh all of a sudden?"
"Dunno. You posh, Ron?"
"Bugger it."
"Yep, sounds posh to me." The snow began to settle gently on the River Ankh. "Still, Happy New Year, Arnold."
"Happy New Year, Duckman. And your duck."
"What duck?"
"Happy New Year, Henry."
"Happy New Year, Ron." "Bugger 'em."
"And God bless us, everyone," said Arnold sideways.
The curtain of snow hid them from view. "Which god?"
"Dunno. What have you got?"
"Duck man."
"Yes, Henry?"
"You know that stalled ox you mentioned?"
"Yes, Henry."
"How come it had stalled? Run out of grass or something?"
"Ah, it was more a figure of speech, Henry."
"Not an ox?"
"Not exactly. What I meant was..." And then there was only the snow. After a while, it began to melt in the sun. That is the end of Hogfather. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Nigel Planer.